Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Patricia McMillan. I'm from the Council of Australian University Directors of IT. And this is a session on international privacy laws for global universities. Just a couple of housekeeping messages. I meant to remind you to fill out the speaker evaluation form, the session evaluation form, which you can do online through the conference website or at any of the kiosks that are set up. And also to remind you that, what am I meant to remind you of? There's recordings available for sale in the registration area of the sessions if you're interested in that. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce Tracy Matrano. Tracy is the Director of IT Policy and University Computer Policy and Law Program in the Office of Information Technologies at Cornell University. Dr. Matrano has a doctorate in American history from Binghamton University and a law degree from Cornell Law School. She's also the Cornell Director of the EDUCAUSE Cornell Institute for Computer Policy and Law Program. Please join me in welcoming Tracy.
Thank you, Patricia, so much, and welcome everyone to EDUCAUSE 2010. My name is Tracy Matrano, and I am going to talk at a very broad level about European privacy laws, largely in the interest of our growing globalization within higher education. How many people are from Europe here and really should be the person standing up and giving this talk? And how many people are from places outside the United States? Certainly the developed world, thank you, has been a part of the intensity of privacy laws that the United States still has not really emulated. So I also want to encourage people to interrupt me at any time, and I hope to not take all of our time just delivering content. I really would prefer to have a conversation, although I would like to give you just some foundation material in the event that that's why you have come here. I hope to offer you something to be able to take back to think about, or if your institution is engaged in a collaboration with the European Union in particular, or anywhere in the developing world that has already assimilated to some of the provisions that I'm going to speak about today, you may be of some assistance on your campus to provide information about at least where to look about what these laws are and just have a framework of the kinds of provisions that you might need to comply with, either to be a good partner in your collaboration or to be compliant legally. I want to say one more thing by way of introduction. Many of you are familiar with the Clementi case here in the United States just a week or so ago. The very unfortunate situation where a young man who was being filmed surreptitiously in a sexual act learned of this filming that was then put online and eventually jumped off the George Washington Bridge in New York City and committed suicide over what was so clearly an invasion of his privacy. And so you're already beginning to ask, what do European privacy laws have to do with this case? And I want to suggest to you they have a great deal to do with it. And it is because of these kinds of incidents that we must, in the United States, be thinking about privacy laws. What is the floor of legal protection upon which social expectation is shaped, such that we can maintain a sense of fundamental autonomy and personal privacy in a way that we can continue to be the citizens that we all aspire to be and engage in the kind of citizenship that being in higher education is all about modeling, certainly for our students, but also for our faculty and all of us as staff as well. So while many of the things that I'm going to talk about are abstract, they are legal, they are in declarations and provisions, fair information practices include dot, 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 dot. I really want us to be thinking about these dot, dot, dots in the context of things that are indeed very real, very important for all of us here in American society and around the world as well. History matters. And to understand the European perspectives on privacy, theoretically or in practice, is to understand European 20th century history. and in particular the political climate in the aftermath of the Second World War and the reaction to the trauma of the Nazi era, especially. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, we take note, was only 3 years after the end of the Second World War, and its declaration is tied to that experience, principally because information that had been gathered about people in perhaps a benign way throughout the 19-teens and 20s and 30s then became fodder when a government goes so inhumanely rogue, as we know the Nazi government did, or other governments can do too. I only want to say that because it was indeed based on that Second World War experience that the framers of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights wrote this document. Now, I'm not going to take us through every single chapter and verse of the provisions, but I do want to highlight a few principal concepts that continue to frame not only the subsequent documents to which I will speak, but also the concept of privacy that is taking shape in the developed world and to which the United States is in a certain kind of tension. So the first paragraph asserts the recognition of a human dignity of all people as the foundation of justice and peace in the world. And it goes on to talk about disregard and contempt for human rights that was so obvious in the catastrophes of the Second World War, the barbarous acts, and to continue to tie those experiences to concepts that are dear to so many people's hearts. Certainly in the United States, speech would be one, of belief, the ability to do so freely in the exercise of religious expression, and to have some freedom from want and fear. A third paragraph establishes rule of law as a counter to tyranny and its arbitrary and capricious and inhumane actions, universal respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms, affirmation of faith in the fundamental human rights and dignity and worth of the human person, promotion of universal respect, a common understanding. And in the context of these very lofty and laudable and critically important rights, expectations of the relationship of an individual to the society, we have a statement on privacy. No one shall be subjected to arbitrary interference with his family, privacy, home, or correspondence, and I have highlighted correspondence because of the communicative nature of the work that we do, nor attacks upon honor, reputation. Everyone has the right to the protection of the law against such interference or attacks. Why am I focusing on this? Well, I'm setting a larger context of these rules that will emerge as a result of this concept of human rights declared in 1948. I also want to say that it's a very important counter to the bromide you have all heard about where privacy rests in the jurisprudence and Constitution of the United States. I am sure I'm not going to be the first person to tell you that our Constitution has no word privacy in it. Whether we're talking about the original Constitution of 1789 or the Bill of Rights or all of the subsequent amendments to the Constitution after the Bill of Rights, that would be 11 through, what are we up to, 28 or something like that. You probably also all know that a concept of privacy emerged out of 1960s jurisprudence regarding contraception and reproductive freedom. And so we have heard about privacy in a certain kind of context that has been fraught with tension and controversy. And unfortunately, all too often, it is difficult to both separate and make the connections to the concepts of privacy that have emerged out of this particular brand of jurisprudence. There are also reasons in the United States why we don't have foundational documents articulating this word. That might be another conversation, but let me just throw out the thought that historically, it well may be that privacy did not need to be articulated in the 18th century, only with the advent of technology and its continued emergence and importance in global society Have we seen the rise of a need to talk about a concept of privacy? There is undoubtedly a relationship between the two. That relationship was established in the 1890 seminal article of Brandeis and Warren, in which the notion of privacy gets introduced to American law. And four torts emerged out of that. It's the foundational document if anyone wants to begin understanding anything about privacy in American jurisprudence. It is referred to repeatedly in legal tracts and discussions. But we are at a disadvantage, one might say, as we try to harmonize ourselves with what's going on in the developed world in terms of privacy in law, because we don't have a notion of privacy as a foundation. It was as a result of the acts of the Second World War that when Europe was reconstructing itself, it made privacy part of that foundation. There's a little larger historical reason as to why there's this difference between us and them, if you will. Okay, so let's get drilled down now to data. And this is a derivative of these larger concepts. In 1995, the European Union established the Data Protection Directive, and it regulates the processing of personal data within the European Union. Now, I know that you have all been dealing with PPI now for at least 5 years, maybe 10 years. This is a concept that already had been dealt with, again, because of the history. They understood the reason for protecting personally identifiable information. It had consequences in their society. I think in the United States it has taken the prolific use of technologies, the data mining, gathering, recombining, profiling, as well as identity theft as a fact to make us now conscious of PPI, personally protected information. But already in the European Union, with this history, they had a more sophisticated and developed concept of it. So it obliges the signatories to enact legislation concerning the automatic processing of personal data. And you can see here, and I believe that there's some way that these slides can be made available through EDUCAUSE so that you can read a little bit more carefully, but information relating to an identifiable person, how they can be identified, so forth and so on. But note, they don't make it, if you read these kinds of data breach notification laws we have in so many of our states in the United States, it's a very reduced concept of your name and a driver's license, social security number, bank routing number, credit card number, so on and so forth. Already here, we have something that is tied to a broader concept, one or more factors specific to his physical, physiological, mental, economic, cultural, or social identity. I bet in this context it won't be any surprise to you to learn that right away when IP addresses became part of how people got information, IP addresses, internet protocol addresses, were considered part of that long laundry list of social security number, bank routing number, and so forth and so on, because there was a context to put what we would have originally thought of. It's just an IP address. No one even knows what it is. Probably most people don't even know how to find what IP address they're connecting to. There was a concept there that already gave it protection. It still is not protected in the United States. If there's one concept you want to leave this session with to research more, take back to your campuses, you may ask the question, okay, great, you've given us this history, you told us something about the laws. I want to be able to go back and tell my CIO or the vice president, this is what we might want to consider doing at our institution. It would be under this topic, fair information practices. These are the generalized practices that would appear to provide the degree of privacy appropriate to the individual and his or her relationship to the rest of the world in which that person lives. Is the rest of the world their relationship to their business contracts, their internet service provider, their credit card company, their institution where they are a student or an employee, or their government? Across the board, if you can have notice of the fact that data about you is being collected, if you can have an understanding as to the purpose, as to why the entity that's collecting it is collecting it, they may have, all of these things may be good and right and appropriate, but the idea is to ask these series of questions as part of a practice that either you as the individual would want to have with the entities that collect information about you, or you representing an institution that's collecting that information wants to establish the appropriate approach to that information and that person. These are the questions to act. Giving notice that you're collecting, the purpose for which you're collecting, that you have consent for the collection of that information. And by the way, that consent be right up front. Sidebar, was down in the exhibit hall, saw a really great software that was being advertised for college admissions. I don't know if the vendor is here. It's not a reflection on the vendor. The software looked quite excellent. So if a prospective student, is looking at the website for admissions and wants to get information, it was a terrific interface. What was fascinating was the amount of information that was being collected about how the person was searching. And the idea is if you have that information, you might get into a chat with that person and say, wow, you know, you keep looking at our athletics, and then you did baseball. So, you know, can we tell you more about so forth and so on, to make it interactive, to bring the student in. It may have a very good purpose, but I asked him, you know, I didn't notice on your front page that you had a statement letting the user know that you're on an interactive time basis in monitoring this information, and that you're going to use it to respond to the person and interact. He said, oh, well, okay, here's an area if your institution wants to put that up. And if I were queen for a day, I would say, yes, our institution would want to let that person know if we used that software. If I were queen for a day, I would say, this should be a law in our country so that the individual has given consent, either implicitly because they have the rule given to them right at the outset of their engagement in the program, or a pop-down window that would say, you know, we would love for you to use this program, but we want you to know that we are looking at the information and we may be responding to the specific information that you are providing. Security of that data. This is an interesting aspect of the relationship between security and privacy. True, you do not have privacy if you have no security. Because if someone can break in, or from either a technical means or a physical means, and get your personally identifiable information, they could splay it out in the middle of your college town if it's your transcripts of your students, or if it's personally identifiable information, they could sell it to the highest criminal bidder and you can have your identity compromised. But security is not privacy. These concepts in the United States are conflated over and over and over again. Security is not privacy. Security, administratively, are the rules that you've established as to how you maintain security on your campus. Technologically, what those specific rules are and how they work. So you're using a certain kind of encryption program to hold confidential information, and you have basic standards that you require of all users and computers that house that information, and physical security that the information is always going to be behind a locked door with a guard at the front gate. Whatever the rules are, the security is really how you do it. The privacy is essentially these practices that you establish to be sure that there is a fair relationship between the entity and the individual and their personally identifiable information or other information about them. Disclosure, if you're going to give that information away, you have to let the person know that you have done so. Access. You look at something and you say, hey, I didn't get a C in organic chemistry on my transcript. I got an A in that class, and it really was hard to get it, so make sure you change it. If you don't have access to that information, and I'm doing a silly example, but if you don't have access, say, to a credit report, which turns out to be the reason why you didn't get that loan for the car, and you have no idea why, because you've got money in the bank, if you can't access the credit report that failed to update your payment of all of your student loans so that now you're in a very good financial position, you may be rejected for loan after loan after loan. So having access to the information so that you can correct the mistakes is critical to all of these practices. And accountability to hold collectors available. So if you paid off those student loans and those credit reporters don't reflect that, again, this rule would guide you in being able to correct that information. In 2002, these directives were made more specific to electronic communication. So it updates the data protective directive by bringing electronic data and flow of information through data networking under its purpose and rules. And again, I want to highlight, there was a right to privacy in the electronic communication sector. I could go off on a very long tangent about the law in the United States here, especially in light of the Patriot Act of 2001, whereby we have no privacy to so much of the data regarding our communications. In particular, that which is called the conversational detail, or the information that our routers collect in terms of source and destination IDs, IPs, timestamps, the volume of that material. Sometimes that material also will have headers, for example, in email communications. It will also indeed have IP addresses that may resolve to websites. So there's virtually no protection now for that kind of information. But with the collapse of a telephony framework for this notion of conversational detail versus content, in a data world where that conversational detail might resolve to content, as in the case of an IP address leading to a website, not only do we have a deeply dysfunctional Electronic Communication Privacy Act of 1986 that is our governing Communications Privacy Act in the United States, but we also have amended to that a Patriot Act that has made it exceedingly easy for government to access that kind of information. So we've really got problems layered upon problems that in the United States we need to look at. By comparison, and I'm not trying to laud the European Union is the only model, but there is, right in the language of these e-privacy directives of 2002, a right to privacy in electronic communications. It is this provision that is the foundation of why an Internet Protocol address is regarded as personally identifiable information when coupled with a name, just like a bank routing number would be. Some of the other main provisions are that electronic communication services are obliged to secure the communication, notify users of threats to that security, for example, in the case of malware attacks that could release their information. Providers of electronic communications are obliged to provide confidentiality. They're not here in the United States, as I have just suggested to you. Specific provisions prohibit surveillance of electronic communications. Now, there's not a privacy law in the world that is not subject to exceptions when there needs to be, such as consent of the individual or, more importantly, law enforcement investigations of criminal activity, but always done through due process. So we're not talking about creating a world where criminal activity can flourish. We are talking about having rules that balance the civil liberties as well as the law enforcement abilities to get information when there is appropriate cause and need. So fair information practices and electronic communications really boil down to some of these principles. Providers of the communications must erase or anonymize data, retain records only as long as they're needed, provide opt-out provisions for call identification and non-itemized billing, give notice for processing personal data for business purposes, and prohibit the use of electronic marketing except for opt-in provisions. Do you notice the flip there? In the European Union, you have to opt in to get those calls. You have to opt in to get that spam, legal spam. I know there's a whole ton of illegal spam, but you have to opt in order to get some of the mailings that we all still get in postal mail. In the European Union is a contrast then to the United States where, and it's not airtight, it's an opt-out system. So it's automatic that you don't get it in the European Union. In the United States, it's automatic that you do get it, and the option is reversed. Consent and cookies. This is going to grow to a much larger issue than it already has presented itself to be. Member states must ensure that electronic communication networks that transmit or store information about a user have provided that user with a clear and comprehensive information about the purpose of the transmission or storage and the opportunity to opt out of that kind of usage for their information. Is that John Krinke just walking in the door? This is a very good time for you to be here, John. John works for InCommon, and we have already been struggling with the question of, as InCommon, with all full intention, seeks a global presence, how and in what way is the technology going to comply with these rules. So as a user is going to authenticate, would we every time have to have a drop-down box saying, hey, don't forget now, you're about to exchange your information with X, Y, and Z. Your personally identifiable information, your name and your password, your net ID and password, whatever it may be, is about to be collected or not collected or however it goes. And this involves a whole different set of rules that then have to create a whole different set of technologies, or at least the interface of some of these technologies going forward. With the development of more sophisticated HTML, this is an issue that is going to become very controversial, and I refer you to an article in the New York Times just this week on this subject if you're curious about what's going on in that vein. To follow up a little bit, because I originally got interested in this whole area as a result of the membership I have on the steering committee for In Common, I was looking at what are the specific provisions that would have to be met for that, let's see what that word is again, clear and comprehensive information about the purpose of the transmission or storage. There's no clarity on exactly how a member state would ensure such activity. Is it going to be a law specific to each state, Spain, France, England, saying that this is what must be done for all the information that is being transmitted in or through its country? No regulation as to what constitutes clear and comprehensive guidelines. No specifics on how frequently a user must be provided that guidance. The very first time you ever use In Common, if you just do it then, or every time you authenticate using In Common, would you have to show it? Not clear. No restrictions on the substance or procedure of the opt-out provisions. So if you're saying, no, you don't want to, it's not really clear then would the service be available or how a user would then drill down and find out more information before they could make a choice. Those are some of the challenges that will remain for any and all of you who are working with information in a global institution or with other institutions around the world with the expectation they might have to how you would protect user identification in those relationships. Let me steer now towards the end of these slides to let you know that just last December, there was yet another declaration made in the European Union. It's called the Madrid Declaration, and they're called the Global Privacy Standards. So we went from the 90s where there was directives about data to the early 2000s when it became about electronic data. And now the direction has been to establish global privacy standards. So you can see the reflection of the interests developing in the European Union on this subject. And it affirms that privacy is a fundamental human right set out and so forth and so on. So it's building on all of these previous declarations. And it's reminding the members of their obligations to enforce the provisions of all of these laws that I have mentioned, and reminding other members of their obligations to uphold the principles set out and so forth and so on. So it would appear, I think, in these declarations that there are still challenges within the countries of the EU to rise to the level that these standards establish. It anticipates the entry of strengthening constitutional rights to privacy and data protection in the European Union. The United States is not seeing this. There's a low-level discussion about some of these issues, but it is not rising to the same level of consciousness as you see in Europe, and warning that privacy law and privacy institutions have failed to take full account of the new technologies, that's what they mean, the new surveillance practices, including behavioral targeting, that's, you know, the kind of marketing that knows you like to dog food and you're looking for a new bike just because of some of the searches that you have done, or information relative to the geographic location of where you have hooked in, including behavioral targeting, databases of DNA, huge area. We would talk a whole day if we started down that path. Other biometric identifiers, the fusion of data between the public and private sectors, the particular risk to vulnerable groups, including children, migrants, and minorities. I'm thinking of the Clementi case as I read this. Warning that failure to safeguard privacy jeopardizes associated freedoms, including freedom of expression, assembly, access to information, non-discrimination, and ultimately the stability of constitutional democracies. I think that statement is a very powerful reminder that sometimes we may be talking about a small little arcane thing. Should it be a drop-down window when you sign on to In Common? Just using that as an example. And you're wondering, you know, why are we going through this great big discussion? Why do we have to rebuild our interfaces? So what are we going to do with this data? How are we going to comply and create fair information practices? I think it's because of these exact issues. They have a relationship to the stability of our constitutional democracies. Civil society takes the occasion of this Madrid Declaration to reaffirm the support for a global framework of fair information practices, support for independent data protection, privacy-enhancing techniques, and meaningful privacy impact assessments about it. So would those camcorders, the ones that, for example, caused a school district in Pennsylvania to have to pay almost $1 million because they were being used to watch the users, even though they were originally designed to catch thieves? Meaningful impact statements. Was there ever a little label that said, don't use these unless the computer is stolen, or we won't use these unless the computer is stolen? Instead, because people have the technological ability to use these things, they assume that it is okay to use these things. It's very sad to think that perhaps the student who did the taping, for example, in the Clementi case, may really just not have understood the impact of what he's doing. I don't want to suggest one thing either way, but what we do see is the technology moves so much more quickly than social norms. It is true, sometimes we're not really sure we understand the impact of a particular technology in terms of our privacy, in terms of our democracy, in terms of our civil society. These declarations are important because they force us to ask these questions. What are the impacts? How can we think through the potential uses of these? What kind of boundaries do we want to create around appropriate and inappropriate use of these technologies? And it goes on and on. I don't want to burden you with every chapter and verse, but it certainly is trying to create a clear and comprehensive approach to privacy within the European Union. And a moratorium has even been suggested on the development of implementing new systems of mass surveillance, including facial recognition, whole body imaging, biometric identifiers, RFID tags, subject to a full transparency evaluation by independent authorities and democratic debate. This is foreign to the United States to even consider that we would tell the market, you can't build another technology until we can figure it out. And we may not want that rule. I'm going to open the floor to discussion in a moment to see what you all think about it. But the point to establish here is that there are some societies, European Union, that are taking privacy so seriously is that they would say something that would be an anathema to the United States that is so much more largely driven by market influences than by these kind of governmental declarations. And finally, a new international framework for privacy protection, participation of civil society based on a rule of law, respect for fundamental human rights, and support for democratic institutions. So what are my 5,000-foot observations before we open to discussion? Europe and the United States have very different historical perspectives on the concept of data. They are concerned about how data can be used against individuals and particularly vulnerable groups. The U.S. neither is concerned about deleterious use of data nor deterred from prolific market influence on mining, recombining, and profiling of data. Europe takes a comprehensive approach. The United States has, at best, a patchwork or what is called a sectoral approach. That is, you will get individual slices of privacy laws. Data breach notification is a good example. Or the fact that your video, which I know you're all just still running to Blockbuster to see what you're going to watch over the weekend, but there is a rule, a law that protects the information about the videos that you purchased based on the Bork nomination, where that information being unprotected was used to in his hearings deleteriously. But you don't find a comprehensive approach talking about all data, talking about it from a federal agency such as the United States or the FTC We have it on largely a state basis. So very little information is protected in the United States legally, unlike Europe, where it's comprehensive. Lawrence Lessig, I'm sure all of you know, is the legal internet guru here in the United States. And most famously, he has suggested that whenever you're thinking about the internet, and not the internet, the technology, but internet, the phenomenon, you want to think of four factors. And I invite you in our conversation or when you leave your thoughts about this issue to be always thinking about how and in what way these four factors play into a discussion about privacy and electronic communications and electronic data and personal information. Technology, obviously. I mentioned something about how our laws are based on telephony, the shared line service, the old AT&T. They're not based on data networking, packet switching. And it's created a tension within the existing law because of disclosure, potential disclosure of content, even when only conversational detail is obtained by law enforcement. The laws themselves, here I was just leading right into the next factor. We've been thrown for a proverbial loop because we are in great need of harmonization of our privacy laws to the global environment, the developed world, and certainly some of these issues that I've just raised insofar as the Patriot Act having lowered the level by which law enforcement can get information, and if our laws are based on a former technology that is now in tension with where the jurisprudence drew the line between content and conversational detail, we have layers and layers of complication in our laws based on the technology itself. Social norms, again, they're so profoundly in flux because technology has been changing so rapidly, and the adoption of our youth in particular, but all of us in general, and how and in what ways we already have absorbed the change. I mean, how many vans have you been in from an airport to a hotel when you're listening to a complete stranger's life story or, you know, the breakup of her marriage or the crazy thing that her son just did today? And you're thinking, you know, why is this person saying these things? But it is so common now that, quite honestly, even though I try to be careful on my own behalf, I have found myself in situations where I'm talking about relatively personal things in an open environment. And finally, the market. And that has really been the driver in the United States in a way that in the European Union, there is an effort to use law to mitigate the market pressures, to push the technology out to users without consideration of the impact of these technologies really suggests the United States might need to think about ways in which it will cabin that influence altogether. Okay, a conclusion. An international framework would facilitate international commerce and communications. If you're all going back to your institutions saying, holy mackerel, we really have a lot of work to do because now we're about to engage in this relationship with this institution in France or Spain or Portugal or the United Kingdom, and we've got to change our own practices within our institution as to what and how we protect personally identifiable information. If the United States would help us by creating laws to which we could comply that would be more harmonized, that would facilitate international commerce and communications. But different cultural perspectives between Europe and the United States, together with the strong market influences pressing on Congress, hampered the harmonization of these laws regarding privacy globally. And so finally, to effect change, advocates should educate and politicize users, emphasizing that which Europe already knows is at stake, and that is fundamental human rights. So how much time do we have, Patricia?
About that.
Absolutely, Mike. I think that the developed countries and the European Union is sort of the leader. I'm thinking here of Australia. New Zealand has very similar laws to the European Union. Japan does too, as a matter of fact. Should all be looking in that direction because I think they are setting the gold standard for what we all need to do in terms of the practices, especially in our electronic communications. And I don't think the United States is the leader in this area. And I do believe that in time, the European Union's model, not to every single provision, not to every single rule, but that a comprehensive approach to privacy will be the direction into which we go. I actually, Mike, I'm going to use your question to make another large statement that would be the basis of a whole other conversation. But I believe that privacy could be the foundational political principle upon which 21st century political thought should go. I know that we have been thinking in terms of rights, but we're in a little bit of a tangle there because we have a system of negative rights in the United States, what the government can't do to you. And in Europe, we largely have a system of some of those kinds of rights, but also positive rights, what the government is going to provide for you, a right to health care, a right to education, a right to a certain minimum human dignity in terms of housing and food and shelter. It might be better that we get out of a debate of is it better to have negative or positive or what Chinese menu between the two and think about privacy as the fundamental principle upon which we reorganize a concept of rights or any other concepts that help us negotiate the relationship between the individual and the society in which the individual lives. More questions? Yes, sir.
Are the laws set up like, say, the Massachusetts privacy laws where regardless of where my citizen goes, these laws apply, or is it
That's an excellent question. You know, what is the jurisdiction of these laws? Because we don't have an international jurisdiction and an international law in that sense about it, it's open. But you're going, ooh, hits it just right, because who wants to be the test case? Who wants to be the institution that loses some set of information about a foreign student that you have? That then finds himself at the other end of a lawsuit in international law over the fact that this information was released. You know, it might not be that information because at worst there would be identity theft or something like that, but say something far greater happened. Let's take the Clementi case. What if he were a citizen of one of the European Union states? And they wanted to say, you know, if you had better rules and laws about privacy, this never would have happened. That's the kind of case that might actually make it up to the international courts. And I'm not sure any of us want to be the institution out of which something like that derives.
Well, something that kind of concerns me is one of my students, a U.S.-based student, happens to be overseas. Do those laws cover him or her? Because then when he or she comes back, I've got this new challenge.
Yes. And you have a new challenge, and yes, when his or her information is in those countries, the laws apply to him or her. So if it's personally identifiable information in the UK, these rules would apply. Now, you have to go into the actual laws that the countries wrote and promulgated to harmonize with these European, there's not a European government, right? These are directives that the members agree that they will go back to their home countries and create the laws that realize the goals of these guidelines. But yes, when the person, the U.S. citizen is there, or U.S. person is there, those countries have to live by those rules. So your next point is well taken. When that person comes back and is used to a higher standard of privacy from a comprehensive perspective, especially in tele and data communications, they may say, hey, how come you're not doing this for me here? More questions? Yes, sir. Yes. My guess is that it's the law where the person resides. And I say that without knowing everything about international law and the whole history of jurisdiction, because the fact remains that there is no global law about privacy. These European directives are just directives to the individual countries to create those laws. And so if it is true that in the Caribbean you have even less privacy laws protecting personally identifiable information, then it would be within that country in the Caribbean that the laws would apply. Not the law of the person, no matter where they're from, UK, the United States, Japan, Australia, New Zealand. But the expectation that the person might have is the thing that's going to challenge you maybe more than the law at this point. That's the key thing. And that's the thing that we have in the United States with regard to our international students, the expectations of privacy that they have, especially with so much information is garnered about them by law through our SEVIS program, the Student Exchange Visitor Information Service that was enacted as part of the Patriot Act to gather information on foreign internationals. Gloria. German laws would govern in Germany.
Okay.
But you're asking the $64,000 question about cloud computing, right? I mean, in what countries does Google have servers? Today. And in what countries might Google have servers tomorrow? And what are the laws that apply in each of those countries? And how much of our institutional information and or student information, and I don't mean FERPA protected, but I mean like student mail, is now anywhere around the world? These are questions we must start to think about. Yes, ma'am. In most people in commerce in the United States would say absolutely not. It is not practical to have to educate every single user about all the implications that their data has given the interface in which they've just engaged. Amazon, a cookie. Hello, Tracy, glad you're back to review our books. We've got some new books that you might be interested in. American commerce, by and large, does not want to have any protection in these areas. And I will say that there is an assumption that there is neither the interest on the part of users or the ability for them to really understand all the implications that goes with the approach that the market has made in terms of its lobbying in Congress, that it's going to hamper business and users don't want it, essentially is their position. You probably can guess from most of what I've said. I would believe in an opt-in system because I believe in democracy. And a belief in democracy means that you've got an engaged, informed citizenry, informed at least to the degree in which they can make a choice. And using technology in particular, which goes by so quickly and the implications are very hard to appreciate or understand in real time, we have all the more obligation to let people know what impact the use of the technology may have on the transfer of personally identifiable information and personal information about them. So my answer is opt-in, and it's because I believe that conversation and discussion about how all of this is happening is much needed in the United States today. Don?
I just think it's kind of ironic that some of these companies, to their advantage, they have no problem of annoying customers.
Oh, that's an excellent point. So, in other words, a click-through license, obligating the individual to their intellectual property rights. Yes, then they're all for informing, allegedly, you know, through the whole thing that nobody reads. No, that's an excellent point. But when it comes to the privacy,
then we're annoying.
Exactly. Then we're annoying you. That's terrific. Patricia's giving me the sign. I would be happy to remain and talk with folks or answer any questions, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the EDUCAUSE Conference 2010. Thanks.